Comics and Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Amy.
And I'm Eric.
Today we have a live interview with Luke.
Afterwards, we'll hear the Physics Bucket with Megan and the Equality Under the Law with Dr. David Borton.
Next off, we'll have Colorworks Radio with Elisa Sikelianos Carter discussing her art and diving deeper into how she creates her work in the second part of our discussion with Elisa.
And later on, we'll hear from Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Willie Terry about a workshop he attended on Saturday called Revolution or Reform. But first, let's start the show off with some headlines.
Plow driver rescues people from burning home in Waterford. A state plow driver got three people out of their home as a flame spread through the structure Tuesday morning. Aaron Gagliardi spotted flames on one of the homes on 3rd Street as he was rolling by to clear snow. He bolted from the cab and helped the family from their burning home, which they were originally unaware of. The fire was put out by 2 a.m. and the cause is still unknown. Waterford Fire Chief Jeff O'Connor credited Gagliardi completely with getting the people out of the building.
While the deal for HQ2 falls through in New York City, it's full steam ahead for another Amazon distribution center that has found strong opposition by its Skodak neighbors. Jansing said the association is focused on the environmental issue that the facility may bring. Specifically, the distribution center being built over their aquifer, the traffic that it will bring to the area, and the subsequent safety issues traffic may bring.
Teacher of Immigrants joins nationwide protest against detentions. Albany dual language teacher Zeo Tavares Polcano traveled to a Texas detention camp to participate in a teach-in comprising teachers from around the nation to protest President Donald Trump's hard line on undocumented immigrants, including those seeking asylum.
Trump is the real emergency, is the message three dozen protesters chanted in a President's Day protest against Donald Trump's national emergency declaration for border wall funding. On Monday, the group joined thousands of other protesters across the country to stand up against what they call Trump's fake emergency. More than 300 events were registered on the crisis response website, all the way from Homer, Alaska, to Honolulu, Hawaii. Three of these took place in the capital region, with groups gathering outside the U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik's office in Glens Falls, in Schenectady, and in Del Mar.
Over a dozen residents will be honored by Common Council members Wednesday as a part of an African American History Month celebration. The free event will be from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday in the Rotunda of City Hall in Albany.
Community members are invited to network, dance, and celebrate downtown Troy on the evening of Monday, February 25th at Revolution Hall, located at 425 River Street in Troy. Doors will be open at 5 p.m., followed by the SAMMY Awards presentation at 6 p.m., and networking and light fare beginning at 6:30 p.m. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM Troy, 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Back in the studio with us, we have the one, the only, the incomparable Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter, the truly last journalist in Troy, New York.
Not true, but thank you. I appreciate the kind words, and it's good to be back. Last week, one of the more interesting stories that I covered in last week's Troy Letter was oral arguments in the David Bryce CDTA case. I'll recap just how we got to this point and just give a little bit of a primer because it's a little bit complicated, but I promise that it's really interesting. CDTA and David Bryce, who owns the Uncle Sam garage, that big parking garage that you see when you drive in from Green Island and past Dinosaur Barbecue on your left, that big garage that's sort of right at the entrance to downtown. CDTA has been in negotiations with David Bryce, the owner of that building, for a number of years, because CDTA wants to build a transit hub or a bus station, you could call it, that would consolidate a bus stop that's currently on the west side of the garage and a bus stop that's currently on 4th Street on the other side of the garage into one mega bus hub that would be a sort of central hub where their eventual bus rapid transit line from Waterford and Cohoes down through Troy into Albany would pass through. And they would all, the bus station, which would not be, it would be adjacent to the garage, not actually in the garage, but sort of along the southern end of the garage. It would have like indoor climate controlled space and they would sell tickets there and they would have like real time information about when the buses are coming. So a real kind of bus station was the idea. And also one of the more interesting things about it too, is that it would have bus only lanes kind of around the garage for easy kind of for buses to go this way and that way and whatever. And it was going to cost, it's going to cost if it's ever built, millions of dollars, like big sort of capital investment. And CDTA had initially just tried to get a long-term lease at this property. Just for the land that they needed, not for the whole garage. But they tried to negotiate for a number of years and they couldn't come to a final agreement. And so finally CDTA said, you know what, fine, we're going to use eminent domain. In other words, forcing David Bryce to sell a portion of this property, not again, not the whole garage, but just a portion, strips of land kind of around it. And to, so that they can build this project that's been, you know, now delayed for a number of years. And when a government agency tries to take property, it needs to kind of there's an opportunity for the property owner to challenge it in court. And so that's what David Bryce has done. He's brought a proceeding that isn't handled in the state Supreme Court locally, but actually handled at the third department, which is the appellate division that covers Rensselaer County, as well as like many, many other counties kind of beyond the capital region as well. It covers a pretty wide swath of area. They've sort of been briefing and filing, you know, trading briefs kind of in that case. And last week was the oral arguments, which is sort of like the grand finale of the case, where attorneys for each side come before a panel of the appellate justices. I think there were six of them in attendance or so. And each attorney gets about 10 minutes to make their case before the justices. Not their whole case. Again, that'll be filed in text form. But just if the attorneys want to emphasize any particular facet of the case. And also the justices have the opportunity to interrupt the attorneys and ask them questions about the relative strengths or weaknesses or gaps, you know, in their case. One of the interesting things that has been mentioned in the pre-argument filings, but just that was emphasized by David Bryce's attorney, is that as the eminent domain process was progressing, there's a thing called a public hearing in the case where just like it sounds, the public has the opportunity to come and make points about, raise points or questions or whatever about what CDTA is proposing to do. Again, take a piece of this developer's property and use it for a bus station. And the attorney for David Bryce emphasized that only one member of CDTA's board actually attended this public hearing. And, you know, they did eventually, before they voted on the matter, the board like meet and they were briefed on what happened there. So the board members ostensibly were up to speed on like what happened at that public hearing. But he sort of was like, you know, what does it say? Here's something where the stakes are pretty high. You know, the government's going to force this guy to sell his property. And the board members couldn't even be bothered to all attend the meeting. The justices seemed, from what I was watching via video stream, seemed kind of, you know, sort of intrigued at least by that argument. I don't know if it will sway the case one way or the other. And, you know, the CDTA's attorney kind of countered that it's not necessary for there to be a quorum at these public hearings. Because there was no action taken, it was just they were hearing. It was just an opportunity for the public to be heard. Nonetheless, I don't think that it's not a great look mm-hmm. for CDTA at the least. But you know, obviously, that's not the only question before the court to be able to decide. And then the other thing that just sort of came up briefly is that, and this is kind of common in these sort of land use cases. David Bryce's attorney sort of made the argument that the environmental review of the project was insufficient, and that the CDCA sort of skimmed over that sort of stuff. And you know, and by contrast, the CDTA attorney sort of countered that the board has the latitude to be able to do as in depth of an environmental review as is there, you know, as is necessary or as they see fit. So that was that.
Right. Where was that meeting held again?
That's in Albany at the third department. It's a long, cumbersome name, but it's like the appellate division for state Supreme Court in this general area.
Gotcha. Okay. But you were able to find it on a live stream.
You can watch it online, which is great, which is sort of rare for courts. Like mm-hmm. you don't often, in video at that, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States, you can listen even live or what all the rules are, but you know, you can eventually see transcripts and stuff. But I know that at least like locally, when I would go to city court or something, like sometimes TV stations will be there for a particular case and ask if they can record, but usually the judge will only let them record video and not audio. But this is video and audio, and it's live. And accordingly, you know, the justice has sort of warned the attorneys before the arguments start that, like, hey, you know, if there's anything sensitive in your case, name of a child or something, like don't use their name because this is being live streamed and it's just going right out. So there's a lot of sort of precaution that needs to be taken by attorneys, and if there's like some sensitive or, you know, not completely public stuff in, you know, in your cases.
Mm-hmm. There was an interesting quote at the end from a CDTA spokesman who was saying that the whole river corridor, the rapid transit line, is supposed to be apparently starting at the end of 2020.
Yeah.
How could that possibly be in effect? Are they just thinking that some of the buses will be running, do you know?
Well, the line is sort of, they have worked on bus stations kind of as in an ad hoc kind of way. It's kind of like the 80 and the 85 both kind of come through this area down along, one along river, one sort of parallel to river, down into downtown Troy. So some of the stations are sort of pre-built. You'll see if you drive down river, like some bump out, some fairly new looking bus stations. You know, they're not glamorous or anything, but just like noticeably new sidewalks in certain parts where there are bus stations. So they've been kind of pre-building stations in preparation to launch the whole line. So a lot of the work is done, but yeah, there's the big question, I guess, is this kind of centerpiece station where you can buy tickets. And again, it's kind of like this hub. You know, if they can't proceed, if they lose this case, you know, will they just keep the two stations on each side of the street? Will that screw up plans more dramatically? I don't know the answer. I don't know if they're probably waiting to, you know, to see what happens.
It seemed like this copy of Troy Letter focused a lot on different lawsuits and such. what were some of the other big suits people were paying attention to?
So last week there was a law committee meeting, which is the city council's, the committee of the city council that focuses on legal matters, you know, before the city. And it was mostly, the meeting was mostly held in secret in what's called executive session, which is just when cities are, usually cities have to, and governments have to abide by what's called, in the state of New York, what's called open meetings law, which basically just says that meetings that, especially meetings of where there could be, you know, fateful decisions made, generally have to be open to the public. You can go, you can record them, you know, you can watch them. Usually there's opportunity for public comment. But there are exceptions, you know, when governmental bodies need to discuss litigation, for example, and, you know, if they were to talk publicly about, say, strategy in one of those lawsuits, you know, that might put the city at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. So there's an argument to be made that those discussions should be kept secret. And so that's what happened last week. But before they went into executive session, the city's corporation counsel, James Caruso, that's their, you know, their top lawyer, basically, described it like in broad strokes what cases they were going to be talking about. Again, none of these cases were unknown previous to this. I had reported on some of them,
right.
But it was, he called them the big cases. In other words, the cases that are, you know, most likely to, or most threatening, or you know, most potential for a big award to be given, you know, to be a big judgment against the city to be had in one of these cases if they were to go to trial.
Or late last year about the about forming the budget of how much they predict to have to spend on legal fees, and it was hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars when you include either judgments or settlement money plus outside counsel. I was going to talk about that after this, but I can talk about that now. So the city's corporation counsel's office, their legal office, is really just one full-time attorney, the corporation counsel himself, and then a couple or two or three deputy corporation counsels who are part-time, who handle, you know, one handles like, you know, traffic court stuff, and, you know, one handles, you know, other general litigation. But they don't, you know, when a big lawsuit, some of these cases that I'm about to list, they need to bring in outside help, either because it's a sort of special area of law or a complicated area of law, or they're just more comfortable not having someone who's part-time handle the case. They want someone, you know, they want to just hire a separate firm to handle this. You know, they feel more comfortable. Or in one case, the city's insurance carrier said, no, you have to hire X law firm to handle this case because the stakes are so high, or because those are our terms, or, you know, whatever. I'll read a couple of the cases. So one case is the case of Jacqueline Myers, who sued the city in state court to recover for injuries she sustained when in June 2014 she fell more than 20 feet through a skylight on a roof at the vacant and abandoned Leonard Hospital. Leonard Hospital is, you know, again, long abandoned. In the city council within the last year or two authorized bonding to the tune of, I think, up to $2.5 million to demolish this property. But because, you know, one of the reasons why is not only is an eyesore and it probably drags down, you know, the value of neighboring properties, but also it's like this attractive nuisance, you might say.
A great place to hurt yourself.
Yeah. And indeed, the very next case, the case of Victoria Lee Brothers, sued the city in state court again after she fell about 20 feet from an exterior catwalk at Leonard Hospital 2 years later than the Myers case in July 2016. So both of those cases are still pending personal injury, you know, lawsuits, basically, where they haven't been resolved. They've been going on. Both of those cases have been going on for at least a year, if not longer. It looks like, you know, one or both may go to trial. Who knows what could happen with there. So I don't know what they talked about specifically, but those two cases are big. Then there's the case of Cynthia Thevenin, who's the widow of Edson Thevenin, who after an African-American man who, after fleeing a traffic stop in his car, was shot and killed by Troy police in April 2016. Thevenin's widow sued the city in federal court, alleging, you know, basically civil rights violations of her husband. That case is pending. The case of Damique McDonald, who was not killed, but he was shot by a Troy police officer in 2017 during when the officer was attempting to apprehend him, I guess. And McDonald sued the city in federal court, again, alleging violations of civil rights. And then finally, and this is the most recent lawsuit, the case of two city residents who have disabilities who get around the city in electric wheelchairs. They sued the city in federal court over its alleged failure to maintain accessible sidewalks, curb cuts, and pedestrian crossings and roads. So all told, you know, let's say that all of those cases went badly for the city. And when I say went badly for the city, I just mean that if the city were found liable in a court of law, you know, you could be looking at, I won't guess, but, you know, substantial judgments. So I don't know what they discussed, but, you know, the city council was, I guess, recently briefed on all that.
And was the Thevenin suit the one that they were required by the insurance company to take outside counsel?
That was, yes. Yeah. They're using an outside law firm. I can't remember the name of them, but yeah, that's who they're using. They're using an outside law firm to represent them. In that case, it looks like in the Damique McDonald case, however, the city is using one of their deputy corporation counsels to handle that case. And then finally, if we have time,
we sure do.
The city is currently looking to adopt a law. This is sort of an administrative item, although it is there's a little bit of interest just because it's a bit odd. The city is going to amend its city code, it looks like, to allow people who have property owners who owe back taxes to enter into installment plans that allows them to pay their back taxes over a period of 2 years, kind of like a deal that you can work out to prevent your house from being foreclosed on. This is something that has long been city practice. So this under the old city charter, which was revised more recently, and that's why this is being discussed now. And it's also state law authorizes it. But when the city revised its charter a couple years ago, it forgot or it was overlooked. They forgot to pass a new local law to kind of match with that. So this thing was off the books for a couple of years. However, no one realized it. And so the city kept entering into these installment agreements anyway, even though there wasn't a provision for it in the city charter. At the end of last year, one of the deputy corporation councils who handles property matters discovered this omission and said, oh, we need to pass a new local law so that this is allowed again. But it seems in his opinion, it doesn't mean that those other ones are void, that he said they were basically entered into good faith. It comports with state law because City Council President Carmela Mantella was at least kind of inquiring as to whether it's legal for when the city passes this law to basically grandfather in all of those previous agreements. So when the law is passed, it's going to have a retroactive component. And she even directed the Corporation Council to ask the Attorney General's office for an opinion on whether it's legal to retroactively allow those agreements. I don't know that the city's heard back yet from the Corporation Council's office, but from the Attorney General's office rather, but it seems like the city attorneys think that the city has grounds to be able to do this. So.
And so they'd be, retroactively making their mistake legal, essentially. But what otherwise would be the consequence? Would the installment plans no longer be considered valid if this correction isn't made? Would it trigger like an automatic default, or is it just unclear?
I have no idea. I don't know that they went the public meeting that I went to last week. No one, went way down the rabbit hole saying like, oh, what if we can't, retroact? I don't know what that would mean. I would assume that would mean some major headaches for people in the assessor's office and the corporation counsel's office. But I don't know. And for what it's worth, I should mention, too, that the someone from the comptroller's office at the city said that that any of all the property owners who have entered into these agreements since summer of 2016, none of them have defaulted. So it seems like it works. That when people enter into these agreements, they're able to not lose their home, which seems like a noble goal, all things considered.
Right. Yeah, I guess in that light, we should be willing to say no harm, no foul.
Yeah. I think that's probably where the Attorney General's office will land too, although I'm guessing.
And you also had a good quote from Mayor Patrick Madden.
Yeah, so the Stewart's down the street has closed. It's a block away. Just on a personal note, sometimes in the summer when I would ride my bike up to these appearances, I would often stop at that Stewart's and get like a seltzer or something before I went on. And now I won't be able to do that. So I guess I won't even. Why should I even bother coming here anymore if I can't even enjoy that amenity? No, but on a serious note, it's never nice to see a store like that serves a purpose and close like that. And indeed, that's sort of what the mayor said, because I asked him, would he encourage Stewart's to maybe rethink that decision? Stewart's basically had said that the store is too small, it's not viable. They've been expanding their kind of prepared food offerings at a lot of their stores. Like the one on Hoosick, they completely redid.
Right.
The one on 4th Street in South Troy also had some sort of expansion. They used to offer gas, I'm told, at that one right here, but they took the pumps out a while ago. I think overall it's kind of too small of a lot for them to make it work, I guess, or for it to, fit into their business plan going forward. So the mayor said it's too bad, but he stopped short of saying I demand, you know, that's not right, really his style. He's not a, you know, he's not quite Bernie Sanders in terms of like, you know, like the way Bernie has kind of gotten on Amazon, you know, about stuff. Right, you know, there's that's not really the Mayor Madden style.
Well, we really thank you for coming on the show, giving us all of these updates and this excellent news. Where can the listeners go to stay up to date on Troy news?
tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or just email me. I'm luke.s.nathan@gmail.com. Say I want Troy Letter and I can sign you up.
Well, fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us, Luke.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. David Borton is back with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. In this episode, Dr. Borton finishes part two of a discussion about climate modeling and the time when Troy became irradiated by a nuclear test.
You were telling me about the way that all of these climate changes are being tracked through technology. The technology is really, really cool and also highly specific, detailed, and complex, right? In terms of the computer programs, that's what you were telling me about. The computer programs that can actually make these climate models and show how air is changing, how weather patterns are changing. Has there ever been a time in which one of these climate models was wildly off, like wildly off? Something entered into the atmosphere that could not be predicted. Like, I'm wondering even if things like Chernobyl or historical events were something dramatic, or the releasing of the atom bomb. Has there ever been a time in recent history where the modeling has been very off? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, if you look at the spaghetti plots, some of them get it wrong, some more than others. But you talk about history, there was a time when an atom bomb test in, I believe it was Nevada, released a bunch of radioactivity that went up in the air, and it drifted east in one of these blocks of air that I was talking about earlier, and it came over Troy, and over Troy the conditions were such that it rained. And the radioactive fallout fell on Troy, and Troy actually became rather radioactive. And
when was this?
Oh, I'd have to look that up because I don't remember that stuff accurately enough. But
60s?
70s?
Sure.
Talk about a hard rain's going to fall right here on Troy. That's pretty crazy.
Well, the reason I bring this up is because people went back and looked at the weather. And the weather data was not as good as it is these days, and the computer models didn't exist then. But by looking back with a little bit of hindsight and good physics, they could actually trace how the radioactivity went from this bomb test across the United States and happened to come down in Troy.
How did they know that the city became a little radiated?
Somebody with a Geiger counter found out that, hey, there's a lot more radioactivity than background. Background is a relatively well-known number, and all of a sudden there was a very high spike in the radioactivity around here.
Wow, that's really interesting. Do you feel like it was pretty random that the rain fell on Troy? Or, I mean, why not the whole capital region? Or was it the whole capital region?
Well, I know about Troy because that's where the history started. Somebody from RPI, I believe, noticed it. But when you say it's random, well, is it random that the weather today is predicted from 3 days ago? There are a lot of, I'll call them random processes in the weather between there and here. But by making very good educated guesses in terms of the parameters of sunlight reflectivity, cloud, water content, energy in, momentum in and out, computer models can actually do a very good job of understanding how this very complex process, what we call weather, actually develops and happens around us.
And you would say that the same processes could be applied to climate, that the same devices and methods and models used for the weather are also applied to climate. So the Arctic ice sheet and the rate at which it's melting is being tracked by computer programs that are similar to what's used with weather patterns.
Yes, that's right. We can tell that there is more energy being absorbed in the Arctic because the Arctic ice is melting, and that means you've got water instead of ice. And obviously water is much darker than ice, and so that the water absorbs more energy than what the ice does. As the water absorbs more energy, it melts more ice. And so there's a very clear example of how these boxes, the parameters, change with climate change.
So physically, how often does a scientist who cares about the Arctic ice sheet have to physically go there? I mean, so much of it, it sounds like, is being done by remote, by these computer models with radar. So, yeah, what's the physical connection in the research?
Well, I know people who do this as their job, so I'm going to do a poor job compared to what they would. But they would look at very specific areas and say, okay, this lake is on the ice. And so a lake on the ice has this energy absorption, whereas ice has this different solar absorption, whereas seawater has this other different. And they would measure these quantities so they would have a better understanding of the parameters to put into the global circulation models.
Cool. Okay, I'll stop bugging you with that question. I was going to say, is physical contact with their areas of research necessary? I would imagine yes.
Well, yes. The more data you can put in that is correct data, the better your result is going to be coming out. All of these things are somewhat approximations, but they're getting better and better all the time.
Before we end, what would you like to tell us about climate and weather in Troy? Do you have any updates on climate and weather in Troy?
In the 70s, I was up here, and the ice was so thick that two Coast Guard cutters got stuck just south of the Menands Bridge. They could not get through the ice. It was that thick. It was great fun to watch them try. They just couldn't do it. Now, these days, the cutters are pretty good at keeping open the Hudson River.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, are you saying that that's related to climate change, or are you just observing, you know, just observing technology changing with cutting through the ice?
No, I'm saying that it's very hard to say that any one particular thing, like a specific hurricane or a specific drought that causes fires in the West, specific rainstorm that causes mudslides, is the result of climate change. It's not the result, it's a result. In other words, the climate is changing, and that means weather is changing, and as a result of all that, things are changing that we can observe.
Well, any last physics messages for us?
Well, physics...
It's cool to think about those models, and like you're saying, all the equations, the rapid physics equations that are constantly being calculated, right, to get this climate and weather information.
Yes. Now, if you think of conservation of energy, that's a pretty simple thing. Energy in, plus energy out, plus or minus whatever is added or subtracted. The same thing with momentum. The same thing with mass. That's pretty obvious. But when you try to put it into something as complex as the way the air moves, then it's really spectacular that these global circulation models do as good a job as they do.
Do any of them run on solar power?
No, I believe maybe the ones in Norway, because most of the electricity in Norway is generated by water hydropower, and hydropower is there because the sun has lifted the water up. So I'm going to call that solar energy. So computers run in Norway probably are run on solar electricity.
That's so cool. Well, thank you, Dr. Barton. Can you give us updates as you build more and more of the solar boats and updates on the boat in Kingston?
I'd be happy to do that.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Barton.
Thank you, Megan. It's always a pleasure.
And that was Dr. David Barton talking about climate modeling in his regular segment, Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics.
For those just tuning in, I'm Amy.
And I'm Eric. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, 105.3 FM, Troy, 98.9 FM, Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Up next, CollarWorks radio host Justin Baker talks with Olisa Sicilianos-Carter as she discusses her art practice and goes further into how she creates her work and what lies beneath the surface of her evocative and powerful body of work, Future Ancestors. To see Olisa's work, please check out her website. That's www.alisasikelianosicarter.com.
Hey, this is CollarWorks Radio. My name is Justin Baker, and I'm here with Olisa Sicilianos-Carter. Yeah. And as part of CollarWorks Radio, what we're trying to do is expand the local arts vernacular by talking to local artists. How you doing, Olisa?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you for coming and being here and talking about everything that's awesome and you. This part I'd like to talk a little bit about your art practice, maybe some of the methods, some of the ideas, some of the whatever it is you do. I'm kind of curious about it because from what I've seen, I love. And what I want to say is if, you know, anybody listening, if you haven't seen Olisa's work, you can check it out on her website, which hopefully will attach to this podcast somehow. So your work, from what I know of and from what I've seen and looked at, it has this kind of painterly aspect, this collage aspect, this real kind of vivid imagery. There's a lot of some of the materials are like gold leaf. Mm-hmm. There's photography. There's paint. There's all this stuff kind of going on. I don't know if I'm wrong about the photography part. But the imagery is really evocative, and it's kind of in a way like kind of has this mystical feel to it. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit maybe about your process, how you put these images together. And even if we could go back, we could talk maybe a little bit about your background. I know you're a upstate New York based artist. You're spreading out. You're showing a lot of places, local and across the country. And you got a lot going on. You're going to be featured in the Opaca show in place of Now. And you got a lot going on. So I'm curious about your process. And also, I know your educational background mm-hmm. was from SUNY Albany, where I also attended. I think you did your BFA there and your MA.
My MA.
Right, your BA. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could start off maybe just with maybe materials or imagery or whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. So I make everything you said is accurate. My work is mixed medium, and it's works on paper, and I use collage and like luminescent materials, so glitter and like mica and gold. I mean foil, like not leaf yet. When I have more money, I'll use real gold leaf, and crystals and stuff like that. And so and the photo element is actually not, I mean, I don't take the photos yet. I would love to take my own photos, but I haven't gotten to that point. But so it's images of braids, which I or braids, dreads, twists, all, like different traditionally black and African, black American and African hairstyles. And I get the images from the internet. It started out solely from the internet, and then I started to order catalogs, and because they're a little bit better quality, the images, and there's a lot of variety. And so those catalogs are what you usually find in like a braid shop. If you were to go and get your hair done, you'd look through the book and pick out the style that you want. So I ordered some of those. And I cut out the images and make like a collage or like photo montage with those. And then I scan them and print them. And so that's like the photo element. Okay. And so it's and like I scale them up. So I don't do anything to the color. I just, you know, basically mess with the levels and then and correct them and then scale them up and print them out large scale, or large. And then, so that is the photo element. And then the rest, it's like, yeah, I paint, there's like it's figure based. And then, so I'm using like acrylic and acrylic wash and ink, just anything that will get me to what where I'm going. It's not like I don't have a particular, like I'm not married to like a certain material, but I just use whatever. I mix lots of things together and just use those to create, like to deal with the ground or and create the surface or whatever. So that's as far as materials. And I love layering, like I love building up the surface as much as possible on the paper, and just yeah, creating a world and atmosphere. And it's just like, it's my favorite.
The work that I saw, mm-hmm. It was probably like a year ago at Concepto, mm-hmm. in Hudson, mm-hmm. Was the first time I'd seen your work, that work in person. Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful because it has this real surface quality, mm-hmm. but it almost like glows in a way that is not startling, but it catches your eye in a way that's like, wow, that's really beautiful. So is all that from the layering process? Like when you said, I don't know, cause I'm not really a painter, but mica, what is that?
Oh, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to sound really like uninformed, but I believe it's like a natural material. So it's like, I think it's like a mineral. It's like a crushed mineral. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah. So it's like, I think pink mica, and there's like gold and silver.
Okay. So that's something you would layer on like in the, somehow in the paint.
On
top of the paint.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so I use that, or then like I'll use that in like micaceous oxide and then mm-hmm. regular synthetic like plastic glitter as well. And oh, and shell. I use shell too. So I'll like, okay. And I would prefer to use solely natural material. So I'm trying to like figure out how to get to that point just because it's better for the earth. And I think I like the way it looks more too.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So the work that I'm most familiar with, you know, just has this really kind of a like evocative, like mm-hmm. almost spiritual feel to it mm-hmm. in a way. I know there's some other issues that you're dealing with mm-hmm. in reading your artist statement. You talk about the power of the braiding mm-hmm. and the meaning that that has for you mm-hmm. and also like this kind of Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. That's super interesting, but I'm wondering, like, is there, like, when you think about your work as a painter, mixed media person, mm-hmm. who are some of the people that you look at, or, 'cause I had in my mind, and I don't know if this is true, but is there like a, I forget his last name, but Clemente, do you ever look at him at all?
Yes.
I mean, some of the composition things
yeah.
kind of. Like I was like, oh, okay, I could see that. But I don't know if there's anybody you wanted to mention and be like, well, I think about this, or, you know, they're in my mind, or right. maybe no one's in your mind. I
mean,
don't know.
So there is one artist who I mean, there's so many artists, not there's many, but Ellen Gallagher has.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah,
my
yeah,
gosh.
For sure.
I just adore her work. Mm-hmm. And so I am thinking about not in terms of composition,
right,
but
yeah.
in terms of material and sort of the and just like the labor she puts into the mm-hmm. work, that really still like just reading and watching her and reading her work and watching videos, like that really stayed with me, her commitment to that. But I'm sure that it's, you know, we're taking from everything all the time,
right.
So I
yeah.
of course I can't claim that I'm not, but I'm not thinking about other artists as much. I'm really not. I'm really just thinking about, okay, what, like, and, you know, I have many
right.
pieces to make, but like what looks good, what makes sense. And it's like a feeling that I'm just like intuitive and kind of going with that more than thinking about other artists.
Right. Yeah. No, I totally get that. I always feel like, you know, just in my own thing that I do, mm-hmm. like, you know, you're just like a sponge, and like, there might be something mm-hmm. you see, like, that's not art that you're like, oh yeah,
right.
I could do that. And I found so interesting when you were talking about the imagery you got of the braiding, mm-hmm. that was something that's coming from like a magazine for people to pick out hairstyles.
Right.
So it's like, has this utilitarian purpose,
right.
but you're kind of like appropriating it for, another purpose, you know, which is an art. And, well, you know, braiding is an art. Maybe it's
Totally. It's like, I think it's an, for sure. I mean, you'll see actually like the show at Opalka, you'll see because there's another artist who has images of braids. But yeah, it's absolutely an art for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
And again, go check out Alisa's work at the Opalka Gallery in place of now, which is opening February 12th. Thank you so much.
And that was host Justin Baker chatting with artist Alisa Sekelianos Carter about her art, her practice, and her work.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended a workshop on Saturday, February 16th, at the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Weekend Caucus entitled Revolution or Reform at the Empire State Plaza. The workshop was sponsored and facilitated by State Assemblyperson Charles Barron. In this segment, you will hear part one of his four-part report on the workshop, Revolution or Reform.
This is your Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry. On Saturday, February the 16th, I attended a workshop at the Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus at the Empire State Plaza on revolution or reform. This workshop was facilitated by Assemblyman Charles Barron. Revolution or Reform, Part 1.
This workshop, shit will come here because when we leave here, we're going to handle our business, you down? Yeah. All right. Lock the door, please. Y'all ready for this?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Every time I say, what's the solution, you say,
revolution.
What's the solution?
Revolution.
All right, so they can hear it next door, because, you know, up here in Albany, you're supposed to talk about nice, neat little issues.
Wanted
to make some points. And first, I want to thank very much the young brother who helped me put this whole piece together, Brother Jabril Jallo. Give him a big hand for that. Nobody works harder than mice. Director of my Albany office, Valeria White. She's black. Valeria White is black. And she brought her mama here. And all the people from East New York, from Mel Faulkner, stand up. East New York is in the house. We appreciate East New York in the house. That's where the revolution is going to start. We'll bring it to your local neighborhoods. So, you know, this is a very, very serious workshop. We want people to go beyond just dealing with the issues. It is important to stop police brutality. It is important to have single-payer health care. It is important to have equity in education. It is important for us to own our own businesses. But it's more important to change the system that's causing us to have to do all that. Never let the system off the hook. So, and don't think it can't be beaten. You know, people say revolution, right? Just think of the 60s. They need to stop being stuck in the 60s. No, everything can change, everything. They say the journey of 1,000 miles, all of you can walk 1,000 miles. Start with a single step. An African proverb said, could you eat a whole elephant? Absolutely, one bite at a time. And they say life is hard if you take it by the yard, but it's a cinch if you take it inch by inch. All right, what's the solution?
Revolution!
All right, we're gonna get started. And I wanna start with Tracy Chapman to open us up.
Don't you know, talking about the revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about the revolution.
Give Tracy Chapman a hand clap. We have to have messages in our music. Because the solution is...
revolution!
A revolution is the complete dismantling of an existing political and economic system and the replacement of that system with a new one. It's a lot to revolution, but when we talk in revolution, which they don't like to talk about in this country, in this place, we're talking about completely changing the system. And guess what? No empires last forever. Right. Remember the British Empire? They said the sun never sets on the British Empire. Now it's a little cloudy country in Europe, barely having its economy met. Everything changed. The Roman Empire, remember? Yes. Gone. The American Declaration of Independence said, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men, not black people, not women, but all white men, they should have put all white men, are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, revolution.
Yes. Revolution.
And institute new government. So the very Declaration of Independence says that you can be revolutionary, even though they weren't talking about you. That was a white government for white people, but since we're in it, it applies to us too. The American Revolution was not a revolution. It was a rebellion against England because they no longer wanted to be the colonies. So they rebelled. They didn't change the system. They still had slavery. They still evolved the capitalism. Nothing changed except they didn't want to be under England. Reform, to make changes or alter political or economic policies within the existing system. Criminal justice reforms, $15 minimum wage. You know, there's two kinds of capitalism. There's predatory capitalism, parasitic, predatory, like no mercy under Trump. We ain't giving you no minimum wage. We're gonna take your social programs and tax break for the rich. And then there's an oxymoron, a contradiction. They call it compassionate capitalism. What's compassionate? Ain't nothing compassionate about capitalism. It's an exploitative system that exploits workers. So you can't have compassionate. So the fox smiles at you, exploits workers, because that's what capitalism does, but gives you a $15 minimum wage so that you can suffer peacefully, as Malcolm would say. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, compassionate capitalists. They support a racist, parasitic, exploited system. The Democratic Party supports that. The Republican Party supports that. But to keep you cool, they'll give you a $15 minimum wage. They'll have some reform of the criminal justice system. They'll even give you some rent regulations and maybe some funding equality we fight for in education. And I fight for these things. But these are tactics to get to revolution. This is not the end all. That's the mistake. We can demonstrate against police brutality, but guess what? If every police officer tonight decided they're not gonna kill you anymore, beat you up anymore, you're still poor, because they don't have no power. The capitalists have the power. So when you put everything into the police, you're not even fighting a real enemy. You're fighting the protectors of the real enemy, protectors of the land, protectors of the capitalists. And that's why the only solution is
revolution.
I think Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, he made a good point on the difference between revolution and reform. There's a difference between revolution and reform. It's a big difference.
in a poem, a man observing a foundation, observing a system, sees many problems. But he assumes that there's nothing wrong with the system. The foundation of the system for him is a good system. Thus, what he seeks to do is to change the building as best he can, but he wants to leave the foundation intact. Example, if I came to this building, it's Ackerman Hall, is it not? If I came to Ackerman Hall and I looked at the foundation, the foundation was falling. It was falling, couldn't possibly stand. If I were a reformist, I'd say, okay, put a piece of board over that. So we cover the foundation, we haven't touched it, then I'll come here and say, put a window there, put a door here, put a frame here, put two rooms where there used to be one. What I'm doing is reforming the system. I am trying to make it look different, but I'm keeping the same rotten foundation.
Give Stokely a hand clap. I think y'all get the point. Yeah, you make that difference. Compassionate capitalism, reform. If you have slavery out of the system, you know they used to say during slavery times there were good slave masters and bad slave masters. That's equivalent to compassionate capitalism and predatory capitalism. So one enslaved African on the plantation would say, my slave master feeds me better than yours feeds you. My slave master, look at my clothes. Look at my position. I'm the chair of the Democratic caucus. My position, look at me. I am the majority leader. I am the president of the United States plantation. Look at me. So you have, there's no such thing as a good slave master.
That's right.
There's no such thing as good capitalism, because the foundation is built on exploitation, and its ideological tentacle is racism. So you even gotta watch out how you fight against racism. We want more contracts for women and minority-owned enterprises. I fight for that. And we did very well in our district, but that's not the solution. They'll give you that. They'll never give you enough. You know how you know when we have progress? When the masses of our people, when the masses, when we're not in poverty, the masses, when we're not in jail, the masses. Don't give us a few appointments, a few people here and there, and these Negroes get in these appointments and think they got something. The majority leader of the city council, you are a vote counter. For the speaker, you have zero power. Y'all behave yourself, all right? We're trying to get this out. Kwame Ture, he was a part of the new Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He was the honorary prime minister of the Black Panther Party, and then he evolved to the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Most of our leaders evolved. They didn't stay at one place. But the American capitalist propaganda machine freezes them in history. So they'll freeze you in a moment that they're comfortable with. I have a dream. But they don't want you to talk about his radical vision in 67. Rosa Parks sat down and we all stood up in 55. After that, there was so much racism, she went to Detroit. And she supported political prisoners, reparations, and the Black Panther Party. And Rosa Parks said, you know, if you keep hitting us, at some point, we're gonna have to do things different. Rosa Parks, the quiet little seamstress who sat on the bus and refused to get up. No, that was a strategy.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Amy.
And I'm Eric. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.